Okay, I think that is our cue to begin. It is 9 o'clock, so we will go ahead and get started. We are in the Exodus, which you can't tell quite yet that we're there. Do I pass? Is it? Anyway, you'll see in a second. We're in the Exodus. We are following the Israelites as they leave the Egyptian bondage. We have so far looked at the slavery. We've looked at Moses, his call. He has gone back to Egypt and he has said, "Let my people go," to go worship in the wilderness. And during that time, Pharaoh says, "No, that's not going to happen. God has sent the 10 plagues on Wednesday night." We looked at the 10th plague, and we looked also at the Passover and its connection with the 10th plague of the death of the firstborn. And so today we're going to be looking at them leaving the land of Egypt, and they will cross the Red Sea. And we'll be looking at chapter 12 of Exodus is where we're going to start. Verse 37 is where we will be starting. To back up just for a moment, though, we ended on Wednesday night with them leaving. The death of the firstborn has happened. And with that, the Egyptians are saying, "Just get out of here." And when they do that, they give them articles of gold and silver and of clothing, which was prophesied, which God had told Abraham that this is going to happen back in Genesis, the 15th chapter. And so that's where the story begins as we pick up today. In verse 37, the sons of Israel journey from Ramses to Succoth with about 600,000 men on foot aside from children. So we learn later that it is 603,550 is the number of fighting men that are there when they are numbered. And so it's about 600,000, aside from children. So if you think about that, let's say, I think a very conservative estimate would be that every man had one child. Obviously, some wouldn't have children, but some would have plenty more than that. Let's just say one man for every child for one man, that'd be 1.2 million. And that's not including women, because you got to have the moms there as well, these wives. That would be 1.8. That's a super conservative estimate of how many people would be leaving. But not only do we have the women and children and the men of Israel, but we also have what's called in verse 38, a mixed multitude also went up with them along with flocks and herds and a very large number of livestock. This mixed multitude, we're not exactly sure who they are. I think we have some pretty good guesses. The most prominent ideas is, and it could be probably maybe a hybrid, a mixture of both of these, that they were, when Jacob left the land of Egypt, went into the land of Egypt, that he probably had some servants with him, slaves, and it could have been part of that group, those ancestors, these descendants of the servants. Could also be that there were people of the same similar from Canaan who had moved down into the land of Egypt and were in bondage as well, kind of just grouped in with them. Could be that. And it could be a mixture of both, considering that maybe perhaps some of the servants were of Canaanite descent, kind of had similar families going back, would be kind of similar in that aspect. That's probably who these people are, this mixed multitude, but either way, they are going to leave Egypt with the Israelites. They're also mentioned again over in Numbers 11 chapter and verse 4. I think it's called the grovel or something like that. That is joined with them, and they complain, is what some of the translations will say. The others will say a mixed multitude. And they stir up the Israelites in complaining then. But they are leaving with Israel. When they are told to get out. In verse 39, we are told that, we'll just read it. It says, they baked the dough which they had brought out of Egypt in cakes of unleavened bread. Why had it been unleavened? We'll see here. It says, "For it had not become leavened, since they were driven out of Egypt and could not delay, nor did they prepare any provisions for themselves." So what has happened is God, first of all, tells them, you know, during the Passover, you're not to have any leaven. And the reasoning in this is that you're going to be leaving quickly. You're going to be getting out quickly. You're not going to have time for the bread to rise, is the idea there. And in verse 40, we are told that it had been 430 years. In verse 41, it mentions to the very day of 430 years. I'm not sure if that's exactly meaning that it had been 430 years to the exact day that Jacob had entered the land with his family, or if it's saying that on that day, on that exact day, they left the land of Egypt. Either way, it's been 430 years, and they are leaving the land of Egypt. And so there we will stop our story in chapter 12 and kind of skip a little bit. So on Wednesday night, we talked about the Passover and all the things that are going along with the Passover. And in connection with that, we have the consecration of the firstborn that is that we went over on Wednesday night as well. You'll notice sometimes in this class that it'll happen a lot, actually, that we will kind of jump from parts of the Bible because the story is kind of connected in that way, and the same idea, the same topic is covered. You know, on Wednesday night, we were talking about the Passover, and that is happens in chapter 12, but it also kind of connects over. It kind of has the story, and then it has kind of an explanation of it, and then sometimes it'll have the story continue, and then a little more of an explanation later on. And so, but because of that, we are going to skip over and join back in chapter 13 and verse 17 is where we are going to continue our story. Now, so they are leaving the land of Egypt. If you can see that, you probably can't see it that well, but you can kind of get a general idea of where they are. They have been in the land of Goshen in Egypt. There's Ramses. And if you were leaving Egypt and you were going to go, they know that the promised land is Canaan. That's where they're headed. If you were going to go that way, the most logical way to go is to leave and go right up the coast, right into the land of Canaan. There is highways that go that way. I think that's called the Way of the Sea right there that you can see. That's the way you would go. It's logical that if you're going to leave Egypt, you're headed to Canaan, that's it. But in verse 17, we're told that God does not take them that way. And do you see why? Let's see. It says, "Now when Pharaoh had let the people go, God did not lead them by the way of the land of the Philistines, even though it was near. For God said, for God said, the people might change their minds when they see war and return to Egypt. Hence God led the people around by the way of the wilderness to the Red Sea. And the sons of Israel went up in a martial array from the land of Egypt." And so there we're told exactly the reasoning why they head towards the wilderness. It's because if they go up towards the coast, they're going to find war. As I was reading for this, it is some people, there's evidence that in this time, the Egyptians even had outposts in that area because they didn't want to be attacked from the north. If there was going to be somebody that's going to come attack, they would go through the land of Canaan and were going to attack Egypt through that route. So they actually had lots of outposts where they had apparently thousands of men of the army that were ready to fight in case that were to happen. And they would be the first initial ones to go to battle. And so I think the Israelites not only would have seen those that were in the land of Canaan initially battle, but they probably would have seen more Egyptians on that route as well. So he takes them by the way of the wilderness. In verse 19, we're told that Moses took the bones of Joseph with him For he had made the sons of Israel solemnly swear, saying, God will surely take care of you, and you shall carry my bones from here with you. This is mentioned, we're not going to read it, we've looked over this again, that's in Genesis, the 50th chapter, verse 25. This is also talked about by faith. He had instructed them to do that. It's in Hebrews, the 11th chapter, that it's told. He does this by faith, knowing the promises that are to come. He had known that God had told Abraham, your descendants are going to be slaves, but they're going to come out one day and leave that, and they will go to Canaan, to the promised land. In verse 22 and in verse 21, I'll read this. It says, the Lord was going before them in a pillar of cloud by day to lead them on the way, and in a pillar of fire by night to give them light, that they may travel by day and by night. He did not take away the pillar of cloud by day nor the pillar of fire by night from before the people. So God is leading his people with a pillar of cloud in the daytime, and at night a pillar of fire. So they're able to see, they're able to travel by day, and they can travel by night as they leave the land of Egypt. This pillar of fire and pillar of cloud stays with them, and this is the way that they know to go. I think it's even mentioned also way later on when Solomon builds the temple that the cloud fills the temple when they initially consecrate the temple, when it first opens as well. So you see it even further on there, or something similar to it. Okay. So when I was preparing for this, I want to show you a couple of things here that you probably can't see because it's just such a big map. But here is Ramses that's mentioned. We looked in chapter 12. We talked about that they had moved from Ramses to Succoth that we have here maybe. It's also mentioned Etham. We're going to mention Migdal, I think is one of the names. So I was preparing for this lesson, and I got to looking because I was like, yeah, it'd be great to show maps of this. And here's kind of a zoomed in portion of it, of maybe the way that they went. But there's one problem with this entire thing. We don't have any idea exactly the way they went. We have a good idea, but there are other theories on which route they took out of Egypt. The traditional route that you probably see, this is the one that you'd probably see in your Bible, takes them here and goes through the Gulf of Suez and down to the original spot of Mount Sinai. The truth is, we're not exactly sure. We think that it might be there, but skipping over this, you might be able to see that a little better. This is a satellite image of it, is that there are some people that would argue that the Red Sea crossing actually happened down here in the Gulf of Aqaba, and that Mount Sinai is in Saudi Arabia over here. I had never given it much thought until I was kind of looking through this. There's actually a new book, I think a very new book, that tries to make a very compelling argument of this route here, headed down here, and Etham being here, Succoth there, and the crossing would be right down in this area with Mount Sinai here. The truth is, we just don't know. It could be there. It could be the crossing somewhere up in this area, and that Mount Sinai is in the traditional spot as we think of it, in what is called the Sinai Peninsula today. The fact is, we just don't know. But here's what we do know. We know that God said that this happened. And so, if it happened here, or it happened here, and Mount Sinai is here, or wherever it is, it really did happen. It's not a fictional story, as some would say. A lot of times, skeptics would say this is just an origin story. This never really happened. But no, we know for a fact that this did happen. We have faith that these things happened. And though we might not have the exact pinpoint location of where the crossing happened and where these cities are, we know that they did happen. Do you have any comments? Okay. Let me jump back up with my slides. So in chapter 14, God tells the children of Israel, he says, tell the sons of Israel to turn back and camp before Pi-Hath-Heroth, between Migdal and the sea. You shall camp in front of Baal-Zephon, opposite by the sea. Why would he do that? So he's told us that we are not going to go, that the Israelites are not going to go the most common route up through the land of Canaan, but we're told that they're going to go the way of the wilderness. And so now he has said, I want you to go camp by the sea. And so I think the idea here is backing up that, well, we'll just read it first. It says in verse 3, for Pharaoh will say of the sons of Israel, they are wandering aimlessly in the land. The wilderness has shut them in. So he has instructed them to go camp somewhere. Let's say it's right in this area or down here. This is a good example. That basically camp right on the edge of the sea. And so that it looks like you could be surrounded. And so the logic of this is that Pharaoh is going to say, they don't have a clue where they're headed. You know, if they, I think in Pharaoh's mind, he would say, if they were going to leave, they would have headed out of the way of the sea, right up the coastline. But they don't have a clue where they're headed. And so it's kind of like the shock of the 10th plague of the death of the firstborn is kind of worn off. And he's realized his slaves are leaving. But he sees also, are you kidding me? They can't even leave correctly. They don't know what they're doing. And so God says he is going to harden Pharaoh's heart. And he is going to chase after them. And he says, I will be honored through Pharaoh and all his army, and the Egyptians shall know that I am the Lord. And they did so. In verse 5, it says, when the king of Egypt was told that the people had fled, Pharaoh and his servants had a change of heart toward the people, and they said, what is this that we have done, that we have let Israel go from serving us? What have we done? We've lost our slaves, these people that were building for us, all of these things that they had been doing. We're not going to have them anymore. And so Pharaoh takes with him, he saddles up his chariot. In verse 7, he takes 600 select chariots with him, along with all the officers over them as well. And so he chased after the sons of Israel. And he goes and he catches up with them, is what we will see. And in verse 10, Israel, as Pharaoh draws near, they see that Pharaoh is coming with the army of the Egyptians, and they become afraid, and they cry out. And they cry out to Moses, and they say, were there no graves in Egypt that we have to come out to the wilderness to die? And look in verse 13. But Moses said to the people, do not fear, stand by and see the salvation of the Lord, which he will accomplish for you today. For the Egyptians who you have seen today, you will never see again forever. The Lord will fight for you while you keep silent. And so, I want you to make notice of that in your mind. We're going to come back to that. The salvation of the Lord. So just mark that in your memory for just a few minutes. We're going to come back to that at the end of the lesson. And so God tells Moses, tell the sons of Israel to go forward. Okay? And so, which way is forward? It's through the sea. They're surrounded. There's no way, nowhere to go. And so he tells Moses, you're going to stretch out your hand. You're going to have your staff in your hand, stretch it out. And when you do that, God brings a eastern wind to come across the sea, and it's going to blow all night long and separate the waters. So, During this time as well, in verse 19 and 20, it talks about that pillar of cloud again. But in this time, this pillar of cloud, who has been leading the Israelites, goes between the Egyptians and the Israelites and makes a separation there. And I think the idea here is that we know that it's at night that this Red Sea crossing happens. And in verse 20, it says it came about that it came between the camp of the Egyptians and the camp of the Israelites, and there was a cloud along with the darkness, yet it gave light at night. Thus the one did not come near the other all night long. And so in verse 21, Moses will stretch out his hand, and they will divide the waters. And so I think the idea here is that it separates the Egyptians, and it is blocking them from realizing what's going on. That I think it maybe is providing darkness to those Egyptians, but at the same time, it's providing light through the fire for the Israelites so that they can see as they cross the Red Sea. And the sons of Israel, this is verse 22, the sons of Israel went through the midst of the sea on dry land, and the waters were like a wall to them on the right hand and on their left. Okay. So, we have this miraculous salvation that is happening here. They are able to go through, which is obviously miraculous, the whole thing is. But they're able to walk through on dry land, which is, of course, if you were to go through the sea, which you can't do anyway, but if you were to do that, what would happen? Well, it's going to be wet. You're not going to be able to get through that. Can you imagine 2 million people trying to go through a marshy, wet area along with flocks? It says a large herd that's with them of livestock. It would be impossible. But God does the impossible for them and brings them deliverance. And so in verse 23, we are told that the Egyptians take up their pursuit. And they go into them, into the midst of the sea. And it's at the morning watch. So we're not quite at daybreak yet. I think the kind of the grand finale of this is going to be at daybreak. But we're not quite there yet. But I think that it's before that time. But you can kind of start to see right before the sun comes up, you can see the lights coming, and you can kind of see what's going on now. And they realize that the Israelites are escaping through the sea. They're going right through the middle of it. And so he picks up and he says, let's go in after them, is the idea. And he takes up his horses and his horsemen and his army, and they go into the sea after them. But in verse 24, the Lord looked down on the army of the Egyptians through the pillar of fire and cloud and brought the army into confusion. So they're confused. The Lord's working against the Egyptians as they try to pursue them. And not only that, in verse 25, he says, he caused their chariot wheels to swerve, and he made them drive with difficulty. So the Egyptians said, let us flee from Israel, for the Lord is fighting for them against the Egyptians. So some of these people are starting to say, all right, the wheels are not driving right. We're not able to go straight. All of these things are happening. The Lord's working against us, and maybe we should turn back. Let's flee. But they're at the point of no return. I can imagine some of these guys saying this as they're in the on dry ground that should be completely wet with water around them as they say this, but they're at the point of no return. And so God gets all of the Israelites on to the other side. And in verse 26, God causes the sea to come back over them. The Lord commands Moses to stretch out his hand. And we'll pick up the reading here. One of the good things about this that we're reading this time, there are times in our class that we have to just fly through, and that we're not able to actually read some of the text. This is not one of them. It's kind of a shorter text today, and we're able to read more of the actual text, which is good. So Moses, this is verse 27. So Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and the sea returned to its normal state at daybreak while the Egyptians were fleeing right into it. Then the Lord overthrew the Egyptians in the midst of the sea. The waters returned and covered the chariots and the horsemen, even Pharaoh's entire army that had gone into the sea after them. Not even one of them remained. So I'll stop there. So it's saying all those that had gone into the sea, all of the ones of the army that had moved into the sea, they all die. Not one of them remained. I think it's mentioning here, we're not told what happened to Pharaoh. I think, personally, that he did not go into the sea. That he sends his army in, but he does not go in. Because it doesn't say that he died in this. Doesn't really matter either way. The Egyptians are destroyed. Those that had gone in, the majority of them that had chased in after them, not one of them remained. They are dead. And in verse 30, it says, "Thus the Lord saved Israel from that day from the hand of the Egyptians, and Israel saw the Egyptians were dead on the seashore." So it comes in after them, and they start to see those Egyptians wash up, and that they know that the Lord has delivered them. Let me backtrack for just a second. It kind of reminded me. You have to be careful when, you know, we looked at the crossing of the Red Sea and all the maps and the places that they could have crossed and all of this. You got to be kind of careful with that sometimes. If you're interested in that, I guess knock yourself out. But don't lose track of what's really happening here with God bringing salvation to them. I say that because you'll see sometimes people will suggest, if you look at the bottom of the Red Sea, you'll see chariot wheels, you know, ancient chariot wheels that are become coral, basically, and all of these things like that. It's a lot of times when it's too good to be true, it's too good to be true. Those are not real. This is not real. And so don't try to always try to connect archaeology with the Bible, because you're just not going to be able to do that. And so that just kind of reminded me, as we see, I guess logic would say, yeah, maybe that there would be stuff in the bottom of the Red Sea. We're talking over 3,000 years ago that this happened. It would be long gone that stuff would have been there. And so just keep that in your mind as you study through this. Now look in verse 31. Oh yeah. Yeah, yeah, that's the great four. It would have scattered them all over the place. There would be nothing, but I honestly don't think they washed up obviously, but there would be nothing to find today of any of this. Now, look in verse 31. It says, "When Israel saw the great power which the Lord had used against the Egyptians, the people feared the Lord, and they believed in the Lord and in his servant Moses." It's in this moment that they are rescued, that they are brought deliverance, salvation. And it's through this that I think kind of solidifies them believing the Lord and in their servants, in Moses and his servant. I think growing up, I associated maybe the 10th plague is kind of the grand finale of what's happening in Egypt. And this kind of maybe a separate, something separate. And they are separate. But I don't think for the Israelites, as we kind of put the 10th plague as the grand finale of the plagues and what's happening in Israel, I don't quite think that for the Israelites themselves, that was the big grand finale of it. I think for the Egyptians, it was. I mean, it's told us that there's not a household that did not have someone that had died then. So I think for the Egyptians, it was. But I think it's in this moment that Israel finally is like, okay, this is the Lord. He can deliver us. He literally crossed, he made a path through the Red Sea. And I think of that, you know, the Israelites would have not had anyone die if they had followed the instructions of God. And even in the plagues themselves, they were inflicted in the first three of them, but they're not inflicted in those last ones. And so they would have heard the stories of what's happening, but they would have not been inflicted themselves. They didn't have social media. They didn't have Twitter or Facebook to share what's going on over in Egypt, you know, or whatever is happening. They didn't have all that. But they obviously knew what would happen. God tells them that these things are going, that this is what's happening. And they know these stories. They're instructed to tell these stories of the 10 plagues. But, and especially I even think with the death of the firstborn, that they know what's happening. But they don't see it firsthand. They're not the Egyptians that are having someone die in their house. And so that they know what has happened, but it's not that impactful of actually visualizing it and seeing it. But in this, they do visualize it, and they do see what has happened. And I think that might be the reason why it's in this that they see the great power of God, and they fear Him, and that they trust, and they believe in Him and in Moses. And so that's where we stop in chapter 14. We're going to get a little bit into chapter 15 in the Song of Moses. Do y'all have any comments? Yeah. Right. Right. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. They could have done it. I do think that there is a miraculous part of it as well. That, I mean, you think about trying to drive cattle and stuff through this crossing of the Red Sea, that it is feasible that they could have done this of 2 million people, as my dad was saying, that we fill up football stadiums of 100,000 people. If you look an hour before kickoff, there's nobody there in the seats. But by kickoff, 100,000 or a little less than that a lot of times, but some of them are 100,000 of a stadium is completely filled. And that's in a course of an hour that they can get in. And, you know, when the game's over, they fill out pretty fast, too, of that. And so if you can do that, I think 2 million people crossing the Red Sea is plausible as well. It's a good point. Yeah. 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 Yeah, that's about as wide as this building, right? Yeah. No, it would have been a lot wider than that. That's a good point. All right. Now, let's back up for just a moment. Do you remember, as I hope that you do, because it had just been 5 minutes ago, that back in verse 13, it says the salvation of the Lord. He says, watch, stand by, and see the salvation of the Lord. I find it completely striking, and it's on purpose, that God delivers His people through water as they pass through the Red Sea and delivers them on the other side. Paul makes mention of this in 1 Corinthians, the 10th chapter. Talks about that they are baptized in this. It's not coincidence that all of this is happening, just like in the death of the firstborn, in the Passover, and what happens with Jesus on the cross. Think about this. Israel are slaves in Egypt. They are slaves. But in this moment, they cross through on the other side, they cross through the water, and on the other side, they become free. Today, we are slaves to sin, but through baptism, through water, we become free of that slavery of sin. How much greater is our salvation today than it was compared to theirs? And this is kind of the pinnacle of what a huge moment in the Israelites' story and of their history that this happens. And if you think about that and you compare it to our salvation today, ours, though it's not a crossing of the Red Sea as we physically could see it, is far greater of a salvation that we're saved from sin than this Red Sea crossing is. It's an amazing concept to think about, and to dwell on. And we could probably have a complete class period just on the correlation between the crossing of the Red Sea and our baptism today and our salvation. Any comments? Others would even mention the fact that the Israelites had to have some type of action with this, that they're told to go walk through the Red Sea, and they're not that they didn't do anything to have salvation, but they are told to take an action with that, very similar to the way we hadn't done anything to earn salvation, but we are instructed to be baptized. So let's quickly go over the last part of this in chapter 15. We're not going to have time to read it, but we have the Song of Moses. And in this Song of Moses, God is praised for his victory. Just a few things. He says, "The Lord is my strength and my song. He has become my salvation. The Lord is my warrior. He has cast the chariots and the army into the Red Sea." All of these things that we're paraphrasing. He has this incredible song that's praising the Lord. Over in Revelation, the 15th chapter, it's mentioned again that they sang the Song of Moses, the bondservant of God, and the Song of the Lamb, saying, "Great and marvelous are your works, O Lord God, the Almighty. Righteous and true are your ways, King of the nations." There in Revelation, they're praising God for his deliverance, for his victory. The same thing that's happening here. And to end here, we'll end with verses 20 and 21. And Miriam, Aaron's sister, the prophetess, mine says tambourine or timbrel in her hand, and led the women with dancing and praising God for their salvation. And that's where we will end our class today. You have any comments? Just out of curiosity, just for your fun facts or something, there's actually 5 prophetesses that is mentioned in the Bible. And as you leave and go home today, try to think of those 5. I just found that interesting as I was reading about it, that there's only 5 that's mentioned. And maybe that's your homework, just to go home and dwell on that. But anyway, thanks, everybody.